for having me here, and I'm always very happy to be back here. So, this talk is based on some work still in preparation with Mohamed Amber, who is my student at UMass. And the work is in preparation, so I still didn't find the real sexy name for the model. So for the time being, I call it magnetic inflation, but it's not really nice. I'm trying to think for something better, but this is the main idea. I will try to argue that one can use actually something that is very much already built in inflationary models to realize natural inflation on a steep potential. So of course, first part of the talk, I will review very quickly inflation, what I would care about in inflationary model building, and then the second part of my talk, I will describe this scenario. So let me start with very, very, very general facts about the universe, and I could collect at least 5 interesting facts about the universe. One is that the universe is an old place and is a big place. And actually, the fact that it is old and big are related by covariance. It's actually very old because it's old on human timescales, and human timescales are long on particle physics timescales. So the universe is very, very old on particle physics timescales. In first approximation, it is homogeneous and isotropic. That's another fact of life, and actually highly non-trivial. If I cut constant time sections of the universe, it turns out that these constant time sections, so the spatial sections of the universe, are flat. This doesn't mean that space-time is flat. Space-time is still curved, but space is flat, and this is, again, something that doesn't really need to be. It happens to be this way. And this is for what concerns the real global properties of the homogeneous universe. Then we look at fluctuations in the universe. Of course, there are fluctuations. We exist. There are areas with a lot of matter. The center of the sun contains much more matter density than intergalactic space. But what we know is that the structure where we live grew out of a small and scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. You can do a Fourier transform of the perturbations, and basically the Fourier transform is constant. And finally, one can do some statistics of this perturbation, and the first approximation, well, up to now, at least, no corrections to the Gaussian shape of these statistics have been observed. So these are probably not all of the facts that we have about the observable universe, but it's a lot of facts. And interestingly enough, all of these things can be explained in the context of a single theory called theory of inflation. So what's the theory of inflation? It's any theory that leads to a period in primordial universe when the universe was expanding very quickly, and actually the acceleration was positive. So the velocity of expansion of the universe was increasing. And I will not spend too much time talking about inflation. I will just, well, we saw in yesterday's colloquium this equation. And that's the main equation that tells us that the way the expansion, the universe expands, is related to the matter content of the universe. And what I want to have is accelerated expansion. The best way of having accelerated expansion is to have A dot over A equal to a constant. Then A is e to the ht. And this is a typical case where, of course, A double dot is positive. Or in general, I want h to be almost constant at least. So that's the typical requirement we want to have during inflation. So we want to have a period in the very, very early universe where h is roughly constant. Now, this seems to be easy to realize. Actually, it is not that easy because on the right-hand side, there is matter. Now, as the universe expands, normal matter dilutes. And as normal matter dilutes, h decreases. So in order to have h almost constant, you must have some form of matter that doesn't dilute away as the space expands. And this is, of course, not what we know about ordinary matter, neither radiation nor what we call dust, that is ordinary non-relativistic matter. So we need some new form of matter. And since people weren't able to invent any form of realistic diluting matter, what they do is just to model it with a scalar field. So the idea is now that there is some scalar field with some potential V of phi of whatever shape you want. And the idea is that at some point in the very early universe, this phi dominates the energy in the universe, okay? With some positive potential energy. Now, as the universe expands, or in general, as time goes on, phi wants to roll down its potential. As usual, all physics systems want to minimize their energy. And so it wants to roll down. Now, how do we get something that dilutes slowly? Well, we require that we are in some region of this potential where the derivative of the potential is small, so that even if it rolls down, as it rolls down, the energy doesn't change a lot. Okay? So first condition need to have accelerated expansion and inflation is to have the potential V that is flat. And flat means that the derivative of V is small in units of V and M Planck. That's not enough, because we don't want just to have inflation for a second. Well, actually, if we had inflation for a second, it would be very long. We don't want to have inflation for a Planck time. We want to have inflation that lasts for some time. And to have long enough inflation, the potential doesn't only need to be flat in some region, but it has to stay flat for a certain amount of region. As the field rolls along the potential has to stay flat. So I need also to require that the second derivative of the potential is small in units of Planck mass. Okay? So these are basically the two only requirements that I have for inflation and model building. Give me a scalar field with a potential that has these two properties, and I'm happy. Now, of course, there are simple ways of realizing this. The simplest way is just to consider a monomial potential. If phi is large with respect to the Planck mass, in a monomial potential, these two conditions will be always be realized. And this is historically the probably the most famous example of inflationary potential is the so-called chaotic inflation. It's just a quadratic potential. Well, originally people were thinking also of a quartic potential. Now quartic potential in its simplest version turned out to be ruled out by observations. This is still very much alive. And as I said, one of the things that inflation does is to generate a spectrum, primordial spectrum of Gaussian scaling invariant perturbations that eventually evolved to into the structure that we observe today. And the amplitude of these perturbations is related to the parameters in the inflationary potential. Since this potential is so simple, there is only one parameter, and this parameter is automatically fixed by the observed amplitude of the perturbations. And this is the value that we need for this mass m. That's, well, a strange value, a little bit below gut scale. So, in general, now, of course, this so far so good. And then, of course, you start writing something, and then people start to like to find possible loopholes and possible tricks by which you can show that your idea is not so good. So, in general, it's true that whatever potential I write at the classical level, we'll get corrections from quantum effects. And so these quantum effects will contribute to the first, the second, and also the higher order derivatives of the potential in principle. In principle, again, radiative corrections can harm the flatness of the potential in two ways. One way is to affect the functional form of the potential. I start with a nice potential and then I look at quantum corrections, it turns out that the potential, instead of doing like this, goes like this. And second, and this is similar to what we actually see in the hierarchy problem for the electroweak scale, it can affect the value of the parameters that appear in the potential. In the example of the chaotic inflation, in principle, these loop corrections can either generate terms of the order phi to the 4, phi to the 6, phi to the 8, etc., 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 or push the parameter m that is fixed by observation to be 10 to 13 GeV to larger values, for instance, Planck scale or whatever other thing. And this second problem is very similar to the electroweak hierarchy problem. The first one is a little bit more, is a bit, little bit different, and comes from the fact that in the case of the electroweak hierarchy problem, we only care about quadratic or quartic terms in our Lagrangian. We are just expanding our Lagrangian close to the equilibrium points. Well, here, actually, during inflation, the field rolls down a potential, so it scans a finite portion of the potential. So, now the common lower question is how to make sure that these radiative effects are actually under control.
The situation is actually not so horrible.
For instance, if we have a theory where phi interacts only with gravity, then it turns out that quantum correction, even the quantum gravity corrections, so-called, are not really a problem. This was, well, first computed and then discussed in these papers. And for instance, let's consider just a case of a field with phi that interacts only with gravity and with some potential v of phi. Then it turns out that one can compute what are the leading quantum gravity effects. And of course, they have to be suppressed by powers of the Planck scale. But the other thing is that since phi is not an observable field, only v of phi is an observable quantity. So these corrections will depend on v of phi, not on phi. So the first corrections one will have are v squared divided by Planck minus 4, and v second v divided by Planck mass squared. And it turns out that as long as v is much smaller than Planck mass to the fourth, both of these corrections are actually negligible, and so we don't worry. So if this is all the story, things are okay. However, in general, for instance, one thing that will happen is that the field phi will be actually coupled to other fields. For instance, it can give mass to other fields, and we need actually the field phi typically to be coupled to other fields because eventually we want to end inflation and to reheat, so we want to convert the energy in the inflaton into energy in radiation or matter. And so we need some explicit coupling, and this explicit coupling makes the field phi now an observable. For instance, if the mass of fermions depends on phi, then phi is an observable and the dependence on phi can appear explicitly in effective potential. Okay, so let us go back to the general picture. How can we make sure that radiative effects are under control? Well, as usual, when you want to do something, the best way is to go and look if somebody else already did it better than you. And in the case of these radiative effects, there's somebody that did it already much better than us, and this somebody is the standard model. In the standard model, we have a lot of small quantities, like the mass of, well, all the masses of fermions that are small in units of the Planck scale. And nobody worries about radiative corrections to these quantities. And the reason is that these quantities are protected by a symmetry. In the case of the standard model, it's chiral symmetry. So one can ask the question whether one can use the same thing for inflation. In general, the idea will be that if we have some effect, some symmetry, then quantum effects cannot violate it, unless the symmetry is anomalous. But if the symmetry is anomalous, then forget about it in any case. And if the symmetry is broken, and that's the interesting point, quantum effects will be able to violate that symmetry only to the extent to which it is already broken in the first place. So all quantum effects will contribute to the breaking of the symmetry in a way that is proportional to the original breaking that is already there. Okay? This means that the breaking parameter is controllably small. If I break by a certain amount, then loop effect will not change that amount by a lot. So one could start saying, in the spirit of what I was saying a minute ago, one could start saying, okay, let's copy from the standard model. For instance, let's try to use chiral symmetry to do inflation. Of course, this doesn't work because we want to do inflation with bosons and not with fermions. Supersymmetry ends up not helping too much and for a complicated story that I will not discuss. So what we use and what is turns out to be popular and useful is what is called a shift symmetry. A shift symmetry is a symmetry such that the theory is invariant under this transformation for some field. The field phi has a shift symmetry if phi goes to phi plus a constant is an invariance of the theory. If this is the case, then typically the only possible potential for phi, of course, is v of phi equal to a constant. And this is just a cosmological constant. Of course, this gives a perfect model of inflation. We have a cosmological constant, the potential is perfectly flat, but this is an overkill, because inflation starts and never ends. So what we want to have is actually an almost exact shift symmetry, so that the potential is flat, but at some point I can get out of the inflationary region. So I want to be able to break the symmetry. So I will now go and discuss what is an important example of a shift symmetry, and that's the main thing I will work on for all of this talk. Suppose now that the field phi is a phase. If it is a phase, then the shift symmetry will correspond to some global U1. Phase goes to phase plus a constant, means field goes to field times e to the I constant. So I can consider a well-known theory that has a global U1, and this is, I guess, well-known by everybody. Suppose that H now is a complex field, this has a global U1, and you have a Mexican half potential with a breaking of the U1, spontaneous breaking of the U1 symmetry. So as we have been taught in high school or middle school, one can take the field H and study the fluctuations around some verb V. So you can decompose into a radial fluctuation and an angular fluctuation. Phi now is the phase. I will forget about delta H. This is the radial fluctuation, it's heavy, and I will just forget about it from now on. The angular part, of course, is the Goldstone boson. What is important is that at this level, of course, is massless. And what I will care about a lot is that this guy is a pseudoscalar. Okay? Then suppose now, so far I have a theory with an exact shift symmetry. And as I said, a theory with an exact shift symmetry is good, but it's actually too good. So I have to break it. So for instance, I can think that this global U1 that I have here is broken, let's say by gravitational instantons, but actually it could be whatever, you know, provided it's broken just by some set. So, for instance, I can write an operator now to this Lagrangian that, well, in the limit in which gravity decouples, so M Planck goes to infinity, the thing goes to zero, but that has to be real and breaks the U1 symmetry. The first term I can write it as these properties is of this form. H plus H star is real, breaks U1, and is multiplied by something e to the minus s, where s is the instanton action and is proportional to some power of the Planck scale in general, times this is just to fix scales. And this has all the properties that I want. Notice that I have put some dots here. I could have h squared plus h dagger squared, h cubed plus h dagger cubed, etc. And I will mention that in a couple of transparencies. Now, when I put this term in my Lagrangian and I write this decomposition, it turns out that I generate a potential. And the potential is of the form, well, some coefficient cosine of phi over v. So, strangely enough, I have generated a potential that has the funny cosine form, and what this potential, this field now is called a pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson. Pseudo because now it doesn't come from an exact symmetry anymore, it's an approximate symmetry. In the limit in which gravity becomes infinitely strong again, the potential becomes flat. The other property is that also in the limit V goes to infinity, this potential becomes flat. Now, the point is that, well, because of this argument that I had in the previous transparency, this theory is supposed to be radiatively stable, in the sense that all loop corrections will have not to be larger in magnitude than this coefficient, first. And second, there is a residual discrete subsymmetry of the shift symmetry. Phi goes to phi plus 2 pi. So all corrections to this potential in loop corrections will not typically be larger than this one, the first term, and will be in the form of cosine n phi. In this sense, and if I can make sure that higher terms are smaller than the first one, and this will be my main issue in a few minutes from now, then this is just the leading term in my potential, and I can claim that this is controllably small and radiatively stable. And this stuff was discussed many, many years ago, and it generated, it led to this model called the model of natural inflation, natural for obvious reason. The idea is, so you have a parameterization of the potential that is mu to the 4 cosine of phi over f plus 1. This parameter f will end up being the main parameter in what I'm going to discuss in the next 30, 45 minutes. Notice, so F measures the extension of this direction. Well, mu, of course, is the height of the potential. At fixed mu, The larger f, the flatter the potential. Okay? So since you remember I need to have a flat potential to have inflation, then I already know that my theory will need f to be large. And of course, large in units of what? Well, in units of the only other dimensionful thing that we have there, that is the Planck mass. So we'll need to have f larger than Planck mass. And, okay, as I said, because of this radiative stability, the PNGB gives it to say the least, a very well-motivated model of inflation for the point of view of effective theory. So what about data? What I was saying before. People, of course, computed the observational constraints on this model. This is an easy model. It has two parameters, height of the potential, extension. And actually, the two parameters are related because you want the amplitude of perturbations to be fixed, and this is one combination. So you have just one free parameter at the end of the story. And the free parameter can be chosen to be f. So this is the parameter space allowed for inflationary models from WMAP. This is 3 years data, but it didn't change a lot. So this is 1 sigma. The yellow is like 1 sigma, 68%, and the blue is 95% confidence level. On the x-axis, there is the spectral index. On the y-axis, there is the constraint on the amplitude of gravitational waves. And you don't care too much about this. What you care about is, well, just look at one of the blue lines. Actually, these different blue lines are not so important. If you follow a single blue line, this is the prediction of natural inflation for f equals to 2.5 Planck masses. So it's very far away from the allowed region. For f equal to 3.5 Planck masses, we are at the boundary of the allowed region. And f, as f increases and goes to infinity, I get in this point. Okay? So as I said, waving my hands 1 second ago, is that my condition is that f has to be much larger, well, larger than the Planck mass. And the constraint is about 3.5 Planck masses. And just for the record, I'm using the so-called, well, the particle physics Planck mass, that is the reduced Planck mass, that is 2.4 times 10 to 18 GeV. Notice also that as f goes to infinity, I go to a finite fixed point. This point is the point of chaotic inflation, because I have this potential. As f goes to infinity, I'm effectively stretching this to infinity. So inflation takes place only at the bottom part of the potential. So these are the prediction of the quadratic potential. So this is the constraint. And OK, one can say everything is fine. However, well, in particular, since we are so happy of this model, we can try to say, oh, let's now try to embed it in string theory, or actually in any field theory. Well, in any field theory, it's slightly better. So let's try to embed it in string theory. And at first sight, we are very, very encouraged by the fact that in string theory, actually, there is a lot of fields, PNGBs. So fields that, in first approximation, have an exactly flat potential, and then instantons generate a potential of the cosine form, and they are pseudoscalars. And by a lot of these things, I mean you can have 10 to 3, 10 to 4, up to 10 to 5 of these guys. And you know, it's enough to have one that does your job. However, people worked hard to find models where you can realize f larger than Planck mass, because this is what you need from observations, and nobody was able to find anything. There's no no-go theorem. Nobody has shown that this is impossible, but there is a lot of people, let's say smart people, that tried hard and said that since we are smart, we didn't succeed, it's impossible. And, nobody has succeeded, so that's good. And so by now, it seems like people are agreeing on the fact that f larger than Planck mass is impossible. And actually, this is not an exact smaller than Planck mass. There are twos and pi's, but typically twos and pi's don't help.
Very neat factor of 6, right? So a 2 and a pi will get you in the right ballpark.
Yeah, but usually the 2 pi's go down. what's the problem? As I said, since it is not a no-go theorem, I cannot say this can be used to show that the thing doesn't work. But there is one thing that typically goes always wrong, and is the following. I can actually cook up models where F is larger than Planck mass. The smart people can cook up models where F is larger than Planck mass. But the point is that, well, as I said, the potential is generated by instantons. And it's possible to compute a higher order contribution by these instantons. I said, you remember what I said, is that you can have cosine of n phi over f terms. It turns out that these terms in cosine of n phi over f, in this string theory constructions, appear always with a coefficient in front of them that goes as e to the minus n, m Planck over f. So if m Planck over f is smaller than 1, you have that this exponential is basically 1. So all the first f over m Planck harmonics contribute to this potential with equal strength. So in some sense, you have, again, this radiative stability problem. You kicked out a phi to the n, but now you have the cosine of n phi that comes here. And so you have higher order terms that you cannot control. Okay? And that's typically the main problem that appears. But that's not the only one. So, of course, since people like so much natural inflation and it's so natural in terms of, from the point of view of quantum field theory, of course, people try to salvage this model. And here there are some of the possible ways out. One possibility that has been considered is to consider two PNGBs and then play with this. They have different values of f, and you can play with the different values of f in such a way that you have an effective value of f that is much larger than Planck mass by somehow diagonalizing a matrix. You can mix PNGBs and moduli, and actually, again, use something similar to this mechanism, and this was used in this other paper. Or you can use many, many, many PNGBs, and use, and by many, 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 I mean all of the 10 to 5 PNGBs I mentioned before, and try to use some collective effect. Each of those does a little bit of inflation, but you put them all together, and they can help doing a lot of inflation. And all these mechanisms are based on multi-field dynamics that effectively generate a large value of F. So in some sense, we try to cheat nature by, you know, giving it the impression that F is large even if F is not large. What I want to discuss today is a different way of approaching the problem. The observation is the following. We can have, at the end of the story, what we want to have is that this energy in the inflaton dilutes slowly. So in other words, we can have two ways of achieving this. Either the field goes down relatively quickly, but the potential is very flat, so that the energy changes very slowly. Or alternatively, I could have a steep potential, but the field for some reason is slowed down. So the idea is that one can slow down the inflaton by dissipating its energy. For instance, suppose that there is some particle production that is associated to the motion of phi. As phi changes, for some reason, I produce particles. These particles suck energy from the inflaton field, and so the only thing the inflaton field can do is to slow down. And so the rate of particle production depends on phi dot, and so is slowed down by particle emission. This has been recently, this is actually, there is some analogy to what happened many, many, many years ago, before inflation. In the 70s, before inflation was invented, people were already worrying about the question, how comes that the universe is so big, homogeneous, and isotropic? And one idea was to isotropize the universe by particle creation. Suppose that you start with a universe that is very anisotropic, but then expansion happens in different directions in such a way that you end up producing particles. And this particle production can help, let's say, slow down the expansion in one direction while increasing the relative expansion in the other direction so that you end up having expansion that is isotropic in all directions. The thing didn't work out, but the idea was of this kind. Okay? So today, in particular, the chaotic inflation paradigm allows us to ignore this primordial anisotropy. If you have something, the standard paradigm is that if you have a potential that is flat enough, even if I start with a universe that is reasonably inhomogeneous, if I start inflation, then inflation will wipe away all the inhomogeneities, and then I will end up having an homogeneous universe. But I need a flat potential to start with. Now, what I try to argue is that actually you can risk, in a sense, you can rescue particle production to solve the problem of the flatness of the potential. Now, you don't care anymore about inhomogeneities, but you care about time-dependent, if you want. In the direction of time, you still have a problem of homogeneity, flatness in the direction of time. And particle production can help flatten, if you want, your dynamics in the direction of time. So this has been very recently, discussed in a paper by Daniel Green and collaborators, and they call the thing trapped inflation. The idea is based on some older idea that has been analyzed like 10, 15 years ago. The idea is the following. Suppose that there is a field chi, whatever. Now, forget about even inflation. There is some field chi whose mass depends on some other field, let's say the inflow, in such a way that the mass of chi ends up being time dependent. I don't really care how this dependence emerges, but what I want to have is that the mass of chi depends on time. Now, if the mass of chi depends on time, it can happen that at some point the mass of chi goes through zero. So at some time t naught, I will have that the mass of chi is equal to zero and the time derivative is different from zero. Now I take my quantum mechanics and I have some wrong directions in these inequalities. And in any case, the point is basically that when this condition and this condition are verified, the Heisenberg inequality, the opposite, the Heisenberg inequality for quantum fluctuations, there's two negations here, is satisfied. Bottom line, Heisenberg relation is not valid, and I end up having that the definition of number of particles of chi is not well defined. Okay? Since the definition of number of particles is not well defined from a quantum mechanical point of view, basically the change in mass is large with respect to the time for which I have that in which I can measure the real mass, I generate quanta of chi. And this has been known since the early 90s. This has been called preheating. And as people have developed a very complicated theory related to, well, reheating at the end of inflation is related to this kind of mechanism. But what I will discuss about today is production during inflation, not at the end of inflation. So at the end of inflation, during inflation, what happens is, now, suppose that during inflation, for some reason, there is some field chi whose mass goes through zero. So the mass of the field depends on the inflaton. As the inflaton rolls, the mass goes through zero. As a consequence, I produce a lot of particles of chi. But now, because of energy conservation, this production has to come from somewhere. Okay? I'm producing a lot of particles, so I have to take energy away from somewhere. And the place where I take energy away from is the rolling kinetic energy of the inflaton. That's the only energy that is available. So bottom line is, when particle production happens, the rolling down of the inflaton is slowed down, typically for 1 E-fold or so, because particles are produced and eventually they are diluted away. And this was already discussed in 1999 by Chang and collaborators to generate observable features in the inflationary spectrum. But this is not what I want to talk about today. What is more interesting is that what Green et al. Did was to consider this thing now. This mechanism slows down the inflaton for 1 E-fold or so. Now, what if we have many particles, chi I, and as the inflaton rolls down, I produce a lot of chi 1, and then this slows down the inflaton, and then the inflaton starts rolling again, I produce a lot of chi 2, this slows down the inflaton, then the inflaton starts rolling again, and produce a lot of chi 3, and eventually, what I end up having is a slow roll of the inflaton that in its rolling down gets slowed down by the production of this quanta of chi.
If I understand correctly, that the masses of each of those chi I pass through zero
at different times. Mm-hmm. So it sounds fine-tuned to me. Yeah. And so it's actually in the paper, it's not so easy to find out the number of productions, but the back of the envelope calculations that I did was that you need this stuff to go through zero between 1 and 10 to 12 times per e-fold. If on one corner of your parameter space you can actually get production by one production per e-fold, but if you go in the center of the parameter space, it's probably like 10 to 6 productions per e-fold. So ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, and slows down continuously the field and drains out energy of the from the field. And of course, this structure, well, this is a stringy collaboration, so there is, of course, a string model that can accommodate for this, and this is this monodromy inflation.
How does all that energy that's dumped into those fields, how does it get converted into, you know, I mean, in the end, you want to have basically the universe to have no more than 27% of its content in the dark matter.
Oh, this stuff is... Oh.
So are these things...
They are produced during inflation, so
right.
They loot away.
No, I know, but you know, this is also happening. Lots of them are being basically made during the last e-fold, when the standard model is supposed to be produced as well. And if you're saying that, you know, 10 to the 12 fields have gone through zero and during the last e-fold, I'll bet you're going to get a lot more, you know, garbage than the standard model.
Possibly.
Stuff, unless, of course, it all decays into the standard model in some way.
Or it decays in radiation
so
that... No, not even. Yeah, I don't know. It has to decay in visible into visible radiation. They don't discuss this, of course. And in any case, as I say, you know, it's in this stringy construction that, of course, I don't understand.
But that would make it...
Oh, no, that's going to be a lot. And that can be a big problem, actually. That's a major issue. Okay?
So...
Yes?
So, you know... How likely is it to have only 1 to 3 events work per e-fold?
It's the corner of their parameter space.
Okay.
Their parameter space extends, well, they have this plot in which they have some coupling, well, this coupling,
uh-huh.
And it goes from 10 to minus 1 to 10 to minus 4.
Uh-huh.
And basically, well, there is some other thing, but they have a very, I don't remember now what's the vertical thing, they have a very, very thin line that goes like this.
Uh-huh.
For 10 to minus 1, you have one production per e-fold.
Sure.
But if you take a point in the center,
yes.
Then it's going to be 10 to 6, 10 to 8.
Right. So basically, Yokoyama and Linder rule. I mean, like,
yeah. And of course, I have a much better model. And here, that's what I will try to argue now. Well, of course, it's much better in the sense that it's much better doesn't mean perfect, okay? And it's work in progress. So, but the nice thing is that I don't have to make up funny couplings or any stringy construction. I just take what quantum field theory tells me. The idea is the following, that in general, the PNGB, or like axion, that we are more familiar with probably, is naturally coupled to gauge fields. And you have naturally this coupling with FF tilde. Okay, now I have this parameter alpha that is a dimensionless parameter, phi over f, epsilon f f tilde.
Sorry, there is one other thing. That
yes.
You know, I'm not giving you grief, but I can give grief to this trap stuff. During inflation, right,
mm-hmm.
the if you want 60 e-folds, the field phi changes at least by the order square root of 16 units of Planck.
No, that's the point.
So it changes by... One in the, you know.
Yeah, it changes by one Planck mass,
maybe,
something like that.
Maybe more. It doesn't matter. The point is that, you know, during this time,
mm-hmm.
if you start 60 e-folds, you're at, you know, one, you're at 2 M Planck, and then you get down to the last people, you're at 1 M Planck.
Yeah.
But that means any time in between, okay, most of those particles, okay, that are massless at the moment that you're passing through the sweet spot, are going to be actually fairly massive.
Yes.
So there is no shift symmetry to anymore.
Oh yeah.
To protect their contributions to the potential of this presumably steep.
Very nice point. No clue.
Okay.
No clue.
It's sort of like you know bootstrapping it and making it even worse.
I can tell you the way they claim they do it. They have this, you know, they have this monodromy thing that is this field that goes around some compact space somehow, and basically every time that it goes around, it intersects a brain, and every time it crosses a brain, it produces particle. You have some enhanced symmetry, like you have, you know, one brain circulating around and hitting another brain or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay, maybe invent locality in the bulk or some such.
I don't know.
All right.
Let's say that.
Difficult to see in the
perspective. Yeah. So this is built in, okay, and this is something. Actually, you have this coupling even if you don't want it. Typically, okay. The only question is how large is alpha, of course. Now I can write down the equation of motion. So now I have the field phi that is rolling. As long as phi is a constant, let's say f is a billion, this is just a total derivative. It doesn't contribute to my equations. But if phi is time dependent, this becomes a non-trivial term for the equation of motion of ff tilde, of f mu nu. So I can write down the equation of motion for f mu nu for a general phi of t. And this is the equation. I can just define the vector potential A mu and then the composite in positive, negative velocity modes and write down an equation that in the absence of phi dot is just a vacuum standard equation. But then in presence of phi dot, I have this extra term that is proportional to phi dot, proportional to alpha over f, and proportional to momentum, but just a single power of momentum. Well, here I have two. So that's the crucial point. I look at this equation and it's plus minus. This means that one of these two modes have effectively a sort of tachyonic mass term. It's not really a mass term because it's proportional to k. But still, the fact that it's proportional to k and not k squared means that for small k, this will dominate. Okay? So this is a negative tachyonic mass term, and so I expect a tachyonic amplification of these modes. So an exponential amplification of one of these two guys, let's say A plus. And the equation can be solved exactly, of course, if you assume that phi dot is constant and the Hubble parameter is constant, that is what I want to have at the end of the story. But just a dimensional analysis. Modes for k over a smaller than alpha phi dot over f are filling this tachyonic mass, and so we start increasing exponentially with an exponent that is basically tachyonic mass. And this will last for one eiffel, basically, before the mode gets out of the horizon. And then exponential growth is stopped by causality. So I end up having an amplification that is of the order of e to the alpha phi dot over fh. Okay? So notice already here, nice thing, the smaller f actually helps me. Smaller f means large amplification. So one can compute more precisely what is the exact modes or the solution for the modes and, you know, parabolic cylinder functions, etc., etc., etc. The important thing is that there is this exponential amplification term where psi e to the pi psi, where psi is, as I said, alpha phi dot over fh. Good. So now I can try to see what happens to the inflaton. So I consider now the back reaction equation. So this is the equation of motion for the inflaton. This is in absence of the coupling to ff tilde. Now that I put ff tilde, I have a term e dot b, alpha over f, on the right-hand side. Now, e dot b, I said, is proportional to phi dot. So now that's the picture. I start, let's say, from the top of the hill. The field phi starts rolling. And then under, let's say there is no electromagnetic field, under this potential, since the potential is steep, it starts rolling very fast. But then when it becomes too fast, then this term starts dominating. Eventually, and it's possible, I will discuss this in a minute, eventually you have that this term dominates, and the equation of motion is now the equivalent of the usual slow roll equation. Slow roll equation usually is you neglect this, and you neglect this, and you have just this plus this equal to zero. Now my slow roll equation becomes v prime equal to alpha over f e dot b, where e dot b is proportional to e to the phi dot. So this is an equation that gives me phi dot. I solve it, and I get that phi dot is given by this expression times just logarithmic dependence of the potential. Yep.
So So you're basically saying that h, phi dot, and v prime and the source are all of the same order of magnitude. All you're doing.
No, actually, it ends up being that this is small, this is small, this is big, and this is big. At the end,
you can reach a regime, and I will discuss that. I mean, for which values of the parameter I can get there. But
no, I'll even believe you. That's just the guy falling with an open parachute in the Earth's gravitational field after the saturation.
Precisely. So this is the slow roll solution. And so the dependence of the potential now is very weak because it's just under a log. And by the way, it's a log of a big number because it's m Planck to the fourth divided by energy of inflation to the fourth. So the log, the whole log, I think, is about 50. And here comes the first, and actually as long as I care about only the background evolution, this is the only constraint on the model. I need to have 60 e-folds of inflation. So I need to start at the top of the potential and end up at the bottom of the potential. And from here to here, there is pi f. So delta phi from the beginning to the end of the inflation is pi f. But now I can also say that the total number of e-folding is h times delta t, or h delta phi over phi dot, and delta phi is pi f. So I put this solution here. I get that the total number of e-folding goes as alpha divided by this log. And now here is my problem. Well, it's not the worst thing in the life, but this log is a big number, and it ends up that in the end I need alpha to be larger than 100 or 200 to get 60 e-folds of inflation. That's not fantastic, but it's one fine tuning, and that's it.
What is alpha?
Alpha is the coupling to FF tilde. It's alpha over FF tilde.
Why do you think you can actually keep E dot B coherent?
It's not. I don't care about coherence. What I care about is energy dissipation.
Sure, but you know, why aren't they getting that loss is 1 over 8 to the 4?
Because they are, but they keep being produced with the same ratio by phi dot. Actually, if you... Well, here, I neglected. There is some factor here inside the log. Mm-hmm. That is basically phi dot over 8 to the 4th. Or phi dot 8 to the... whatever. At the end, A is cancelled.
Okay. So... No, I understand. That's alpha. It's just alpha. You're basically just making this coupling to be strong enough and then...
Yeah. And this is... Actually, this alpha will control everything. And if I have alpha of order 10 to 2, you know, 100, 200, 300, everything is fine as level of background evolution.
You have a big parachute.
I have 100 parachutes.
Yeah.
So one thing one has to check, for instance, for consistency, is that the contribution of E, the electromagnetic energy, to my Hubble parameter is negligible. I have neglected it. In all the calculations, I will assume that Hubble parameter is just, in slow roll approximation, is just V. Phi dot is negligible, and rho electromagnetic is negligible. Of course, yes, that's possible. And the argument is simple. Basically, the rho electromagnetic goes as E squared plus B squared, and this is basically the same as E dot B. And I use the equation of motion background, and I find that this is V prime over alpha. And this 1 over alpha helps me, because now I can compute the ratio of electromagnetic energy over potential, and this is FV prime over alpha V. Now, V is a function of phi over F. So FV prime is of the same order of V. So this stuff is, most of the time, of order 1 over alpha. If alpha is 100, then this is 1%, and who cares about 1%? At the end, notice, when I go to the bottom of the potential, though, this stuff blows up. And this is just reheating. At the bottom of the potential, the energy in the electromagnetic modes becomes important, and I can neglect the energy in the... And, of course, at that point, I have to start my analysis again. I don't know what to do, but I don't care for the time being. Last thing, of course, to have inflation, you need to have slow roll. And the slow roll parameters usually are defined as V prime over B and V second over V. But the real rigorous definition of slow roll parameters, I didn't write it down. The rigorous definition is this one. Epsilon is minus h dot over h, and eta is phi double dot over h phi dot.
to have real inflation, this is what you really care about. It's not a matter of potential, because inflation is about geometry, not about potential. And this is a geometric statement. And when I compute epsilon and eta in these terms, it turns out that epsilon is very small because it's f of n Planck that is small, 1 over alpha that is small, and eta is this stuff that again is of order 1 divided by alpha. So again, alpha equal to 100 and my slow roll is guaranteed. Bottom line, for the background evolution, I'm done. If I have alpha equal 100, 200, then I get 60 epochs of inflationary expansion, no matter what value of f. Notice I don't care about f. My final result is that if alpha is large enough, I get my inflation. Now one can ask the question, can we get such a large alpha? I'm sorry for this transparency. I cut and paste. This is just one example. You can use, again, two axioms. This is an old paper by Choi and Kim, and they were studying axioms in E8 times E8 string theory, and they just copied their paper. And what they have is that basically you start with two axioms with, well, they call it M1 and M2. I would call them F1 and F2. And then you can redefine things, and eventually you can have a sector with an axiom that is coupled to FF tilde here and some new sector F prime tilde. And this is 1 over F, and then there is this thing that can be large if M1 is close to M2. So if you have a 1% fine-tuning of the two Fs, automatically you get this alpha equal to 100. It's not wonderful, but it's a one-time fine-tuning, and I don't care about it anymore. And it's an operator that is there, and I don't have to invent it, and I don't have to cancel other operators. This is just an example, and one can think of other things. Okay, last 5 minutes, very quickly, perturbations. So now I have to write also the equation for cosmological perturbations. I managed to have inflation, I still don't know what the perturbations like. So the equation for perturbation is equation for perturbation in phi, and I will have also some perturbation in E dot B, the right hand side. Now the perturbation in E dot B, before I go there. First possible problem. The second derivative of phi that appears in the equation for the perturbation for phi is large. Typically, this is bad, because typically this means that you don't have perturbations at large scales, and this would be enough to rule out the model. However, this term on the right-hand side actually will end up helping me, exactly in the same way as it helped me in the background evolution, because I was able to get a slow roll even if I had a steep potential. So E dot B has actually two contributions. One is intrinsic fluctuations in E dot B. So it's E dot B minus the excitation value of E dot B, computed if there were no perturbations in phi. But then there is another contribution that comes from the fact that E dot B depends on phi itself. So if phi changes a little bit, E dot B will change, the background value. So I have this other dependence on phi dot, actually. E dot B depends only on phi dot. So this term here ends up basically generating an extra friction term for my perturbations. And this extra friction term is useful to kill this term here. This term here would like to push perturbations down, but then the friction term slows them before they go there. So one can write down the Fourier transform, the effective equation for perturbations. This extra friction term, now I use the background equations, and it's here. And this is the Fourier transform of the real fluctuation, intrinsic fluctuations in E dot B. And this one can solve it, and there was a paper by Barnaby and collaborators to show how you can compute perturbations for this kind of models. And basically what you do is you solve formally, this is an operator equation, and you solve formally with Green function, and then you compute a two-point function of the perturbations that will be just a double integral of the Green function multiplied by, convolved over the two-point function of your source. So all you have to do now is to compute this stuff, and this is possible. It's a little bit boring, but not even so boring. You can compute this stuff. You can compute this propagator. And actually, this is also relatively easy. You can compute everything. And eventually, you can compute what the power spectrum in perturbation, and you relate it to the two-point function via some standard formula that relates the perturbations in the field to the perturbations in the metric. And this is the result. Well, I wrote it RR, it's just PR. The spectrum of perturbation has this amplitude and this dependence on V, on P, on momentum. So first thing, P has this exponent. And this is an exponent that, again, is of the form fv second over alpha v prime. And as I said, fv second over v prime is some order one number. So this spectral index goes as 1 over alpha. Again, for alpha equal to 100, I have a spectral index that is 1 over n minus 1, that is 1 over 100, so I am almost scale invariant. An interesting thing is that the sign of this thing changes as I go across inflation. So I start from a slightly red and then it becomes slightly blue or vice versa. And this is the normalization. Again, it depends on the value of the potential. And I have put an extra term here, 1 over m, to help myself. Because I'm considering the case where you could produce just not one U1 field, but n U1 fields. You could have some on several E dot Bs of different gauge groups. And if you have n of these fields, you have a 1 over square root of n suppression. So the 2.5, the square of the perturbation goes as 1 over n. Final result, amplitude goes as 10 to minus 2, roughly, log of m Planck over the scale, energy scale of inflation to the minus 2, number of fields divided by minus 1. And this is the part where I'm actually the most unhappy about this model, because I have to push parameters here. And this is... So, for instance, if I have energy of scale of inflation of the TeV, I still need about 10 to 5 U1 groups. That is not so nice. Still, you go to the literature, and you see that people not so long ago were writing models with U100 fields, SU100 gauge groups. And SU100 has 10 to 4, dimension 10 to 4. So, but still, that's what we get. However,
so
and
that's to get 10 to the minus 5.
10 to minus 9, yes.
10 to minus 5, sorry.
Yeah, I need, because basically this combination gives 10 to minus 4, best case. And then I need this to get to 10 to minus 9. But again, this is really the part that is very much work in progress, and we are still trying to understand what goes on. And actually, there is one last thing I wanted to mention related to this, and the question is whether we really use what is really the true value of this delta E dot B, that is the right-hand side, the source for our perturbations. And the reason is the following. This is very, very much in progress. As Nemanja said at some point, you have a large incoherent field at sub-horizon scales. Okay? So you have a very strong electromagnetic field there. If there is some matter charged under that very strong electromagnetic field, you are in some stationary regime where basically this strong electromagnetic field is continuously fed by the rolling of the inflaton. Inflaton rolls, generates magnetic field. If there are fields, light particles, that are charged under this U1, and in general you expect them to be there, you will produce a lot of these particles. So a part of this electromagnetic field will have its energy that is dissipated into these light particles. This will reduce the amplitude of the perturbations in E dot B. And that's really the part where I'm still very much computing and try to understand what are the conditions to have, for instance, some form of equipartition by which you can get take away a lot of E dot B. But the bottom line is definitely E dot B will be reduced. And since the perturbations are sourced by E dot B and they are proportional to E dot B, this will automatically also reduce the perturbations. And one could think that this also affects my slow roll of the inflaton. But actually this is not... So for the evolution of the zero mode of the inflaton, I don't worry, because that is actually just dictated by energy conservation. The energy in the inflaton is lost. Once it's lost, I don't care where it goes. And so inflaton, the zero mode of the inflaton is slowed down once and forever. So before concluding, let me advertise an old paper that actually sourced this idea. The model comes with a bonus. if one of these U1s is U1 electromagnetism, automatically you generate magnetic fields that can be of cosmological interest, and this is still one of these cosmological mysteries. Where do electromagnetic fields come from? And the bonus comes even with a signature. As I said, you excite only one single electricity mode of the inflaton, of the electromagnetic field. So these fields, if they're still around, should still carry this parity-violating property that one electricity mode is dominant over the other. And this is something people can measure, and that's not still being measured in a decent way, but I think people even plan to measure this. Conclusions. Apart from this 10 to 5 U1s, what I want to claim is that you don't need to be really creative to salvage this model of natural inflation. I just used an operator that was there, and people typically just want to forget about it. The only point is that I have to have this 1% fine-tuning, so to get this alpha of order 100. The spectral perturbation is quasi-scalar invariant, and as I said, the amplitude tends to be large, but there are ways out, and this is the part where I cannot still really give any final word. Well, I did it perfectly on time. Thank you.
So go back to reheating and stuff. I mean, if you produce a lot of these, you know, hundreds of extra U1s.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you produce too much hot dark matter type stuff?
No, they have time to redshift away.
Do they?
Yeah, they are. If they are radiation, they go away.
There is a nucleosynthesis that is sundown about, you know, how many other extra species can. I think it.
Yeah, how many other species?
So at nucleosynthesis, I think that, you know, 100%, basically 90 something percent of the universe must be in the usual photon.
Yeah.
So if you are making a lot of extra U1s, mm-hmm. at the end of inflation, they better somehow decay, or, you know.
I can get rid of them if I have before nucleosynthesis. Mm-hmm. I have a long period of meta domination, and typically I expect to have a reasonably long period of meta domination. Let's say I have reheating, and reheating lasts. Okay,
so I understand. You want to basically make something that can decay into photons only.
What I want to do is to have a period where these guys redshift more quickly than the background.
I understand, but that means you have to basically postulate that you produce a lot of some stuff that will decay predominantly in photons at a late time before you.
Oh, yes. Well, let me say this. In general, the problem you have with all these models of inflation is that hidden sectors,
you populate
other sectors. I'm not as worried of this as of other things, because this is radiation, so I can get rid of it with the period of meta domination.
But
I can get rid of it.
But it's unpleasant. No?
Yeah, it's.
This is not. I'm not letting criticism to the theory, which is better than some of the others. I'm letting the general, you know, criticism to the abroad.
No, I know. All this model building is mostly troubleshooting.
On the other hand, it's also true, this is all these sort of, you know, postmodern problems. How do you reheat this never clean?
Well, the other point is that I don't, as I told you, this 10 to 5, I don't think is the only possible way of having things working. And that's, as you know, this is something I've been working relatively recently on, and this last problem, I'm pretty sure that there are other ways out. And that last thing I mentioned, I think, would actually be a good and actually physical way of explaining this.
I mean, by the way, the comment about the magnetic fields getting out, I mean, that's a nice bonus, right?
Yeah.
That in some sense, is just finding out that the old Dolgov thing would not work here. Is that, or is it different?
The old Dolgov. Sort of. Dolgov wanted to do this at biogenesis time.
Sorry,
that's the same thing.
What I'm just trying to remember, actually, what he wanted to do is have axion decay into this, right?
No. He wanted to have these things, but I think he wanted to generate some electricity during electro weak phase transition, and he needed axions to make this stronger or something like that. But that was his idea. That was his idea, and this just automatically gives that kind of magnetic fields. But that's true.
Let me put it this way. Let's change the story a little bit. Suppose you just say, you know, forget about messing around with stick potentials. Just you know, write down a usual inflationary potential with a small enough mass and so on and so forth. And I'll just say, let that inphoton axion couple to the usual photon.
Yes.
Forget about everything else.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need 200 species to keep it potential.
No.
Does this by itself produce the magnetic fields that you need to explain the primordial seed fields?
Yes. It depends on parameters, but you can cook up a simple model that is not excluded, that is not fine, apart from this large F. Suppose that somebody gives you, suppose somebody is able to do chaotic inflation with a pseudo-scalar.
Right.
And you can tune the height of the potential.
How big an F do you need for that?
What is 10 to minus scale? 2 Planck masses.
Okay, that scale.
Yeah, that scale. Larger, even larger than that. 10 to minus 2 Planck masses, you're doing great.
There's no more questions.
Okay. Thank you.